This is Jessica Ortner, and I want to give you a big welcome to this very special Tapping World Summit bonus. In 2007, we were thrilled to have the opportunity to interview Bruce Lipton for our film, The Tapping Solution. This audio was never meant to be released to the public, which is why I don't have a microphone on while I'm asking my questions. Yet we found Bruce's information so eye-opening that we still wanted to make this audio available to you. We found Bruce so interesting, in fact, that we didn't stop asking him questions and we ended up missing our plane ride home. Enjoy the audio.
My name is Bruce Lipton. I'm an old guy. I grew up in Westchester County, New York. And in my youth, I started to realize that seeking truths about the world. I heard lots of interesting truths from so-called spiritual people, but then saw their lives never match their truths. And then as I started to get older, realized that science was where I would go find my truths about life. And so I was not a spiritual person at all, got into the science, and was, of course, ingrained with the conventional beliefs of Darwinian biology and genes control life and genetic automatons, biochemical machines, all that kind of stuff. And I had the great fortune of getting my PhD at the University of Virginia under a brilliant scientist by the name of Erwin Konigsberg, and he was one of the first people to clone stem cells. So I actually was doing stem cell cultures in 1967, so that's 40 years ago. Well, people think stem cells are this brand new thing. It's like, no, stem cells have been around for a long time, except a very exclusive club studying them. And the beautiful part about my stem cell research was, as I started to do this and I was cloning genetically identical cells, I started to realize that if I would take these genetically identical cells and put them into separate petri dishes and then change the environment in those dishes, that in one dish they will form muscle, in another dish they'll form bone, and yet in a third dish they would form fat by changing the conditions. You stop for a second and realize, well, wait, they were all genetically identical. So what is it that controlled why they became muscle or bone or fat? And the answer was very obvious. It was like information from the environment. So this started to lead me on a different trail than all my colleagues who were getting focused on the genome and, you know, building up the background to create the genome project while I was doing this. So I was taking the road less traveled at that time. I was looking into the role of how the environment influences the expression of cells while everyone else was looking at how genes control cells. And yet my papers were published in very prestigious journals. And the results were very clear. It wasn't even ambiguous. It was that the fate of the cells was primarily determined by the environment that cells find themselves in. So when I published this, I was, of course, very excited by this, but then found myself to be a very small crowd of one in my community, because I had violated, mind you, what is called the central dogma. The central dogma is the pillar of modern biomedicine today. It was a concept that was coined by Francis Crick, the guy, one of the co-discoverers with Jim Watson of the DNA double helix. And the central dogma simply says this, and you're very familiar with it, is that the flow of information in biology goes from DNA to RNA to protein. And this is established in all the textbooks. It's still in all the textbooks at this very moment. So it says information flows from DNA down. And therefore, since your body, which is made out of protein, and the proteins are coded for by the DNA, then we adopt the belief, as the dogma says, that your fate and your lot in life is determined by the genes you receive at conception. So we become victims of our heredity in this sense, if you understand it from this point, that you didn't pick your genes and you can't change your genes. And since your genes control your life, then you're a victim to those particular genes. That is the message that conventional science has been teaching. And the issue is that's totally false. And I loved it because not only did my research on these cell cultures, stem cell cultures, reveal that, but I also did other research. It was based on experiments from almost 100 years ago, where scientists, an early cell scientist, were removing the nuclei from cells. And the nucleus is where all the genes are. And the beautiful part about it is you can remove the nucleus from a cell and the cell doesn't stop and the life doesn't end. Cell goes on doing everything it was doing before. Coordinated functions of breathing and eating and moving and dealing with the environment and all this kind of stuff without genes. Many cells can live for 2 or more months without genes. So you look and you say, wait, if the cell has a life and it's still, you know, it's coordinated, it's not random, it's coordinated expression, then the genes cannot be controlling it if the genes aren't even in the cell. And this is where my research started to say, okay, I'm familiar with the fact that the environment is influencing this, but we didn't have a mechanism or pathway by which environmental signals control gene activity. That became the focus of my research. And at some point, finding that I was now a heretic because I was challenging the dogma, which is funny, as a sidebar here, the central dogma is the actual name of this belief. And it was interesting because when I got out of medicine, and I actually looked backwards, and I said, you know, I never really looked up the word dogma, and I looked it up in a dictionary, and I was shocked because the definition for the word dogma is a truth based on religious persuasion and not scientific fact. And all of a sudden I realized, oh my God, the central fundamental belief of biomedicine is a religious belief, which it was and is, because it wasn't based on scientific fact. It was just based because everybody believed this is what was going to happen, so they just jumped to the conclusion. And so challenging the dogma officially makes me a heretic, and what was called science, but by definition now, is more religion. And so I didn't mind being a heretic in the religion called materialistic science is where I was practicing. So I left the field, walked out of the university, did strange things in my what you would call midlife crisis, you know. Not only did I drop my career and all that stuff, but I actually went on the road and produced a rock and roll show and lost all my money, had a great time, and brought a musician to the world, which is interesting. His name is Yanni, and found him as a PhD student and said, why are you wasting your time doing that when you could play music? So that was part of the road show. But I was fortunate because during that time when I was out of the university, I had a lot of free time, and I started reading into quantum mechanics. And once I started to understand quantum mechanics, my life had a very profound change to it for a very simple reason, and that is this. Quantum mechanics, or quantum physics, is the science of physics. And as the name said, quantum mechanics, quantum physics and mechanics are synonyms. So what is physics? It's the mechanisms by which things happen in our universe. The important part about this is that the mechanisms, as I had studied it, and as all my colleagues in the medical school have studied it, so as you understand the terms quantum physics and quantum mechanics, or Newtonian physics and Newtonian mechanics, what you see is that physics and mechanics are synonyms. So physics really means the mechanisms by which the universe operates. And the new physics, quantum physics, was something that I really wasn't into, nor were any of my colleagues in the medical school. We were all trained in Newtonian physics. And the difference between the two is very profound. Newtonian physics says the world that we live in, the universe we live in, is a machine made out of mechanical parts. If you want to understand how it works, take it apart, study the pieces, change the operation. That's the basis of medicine. We look at a human body, it's a machine made out of physical parts. When it's not working right, change the parts by buying chemicals and drugs. And that's the way that conventional medicine operates. When I started to read the quantum physics, I realized, oh my goodness, the whole foundation of the universe is not based on a mechanical, physical universe. It's based on the invisible energy called the field. So let's say if I hold a magnet right here in front of you, and you can see the magnet, but what you can't see is the invisible magnetic field. And so what it says is, well, we are physical things in our world, like physical bodies. We're immersed in fields, electromagnetic fields, magnetic fields itself, all kinds of fields like telephone, cell phone fields, television fields, radio fields, whole ranges. What is the difference between the Newtonian physics and the quantum physics is this. Newtonian physics focuses on the particles. Quantum physics says, you want to understand why the particles take this shape? Then you have to understand the field. It's the field that controls biology. It's the invisible forces. There's a great quote by Albert Einstein, and it's simple. It goes, the field is the sole governing agency of the particle. In other words, in the world of invisible things, fields, and particles, matter, it's the field that gives shape to the matter. And this is the basis of quantum physics. This becomes relevant. It says, okay, here's the physical particles of my body. Why are they in a healthy state, or why could they be in a sick state? That's the physical expression. And the answer is, well, to understand that, don't look at the body. You have to understand the invisible forces in the field. It's fun, because if you think about it, when you were young, at some point you must have had like iron filings and sprinkled it around a magnet, and all of a sudden you saw the iron filings form that pattern of the magnetic field. Well, quantum physics would look at this pattern and try to explain how come all the iron filings fell in this pattern without recognizing that the field exists. In other words, can you explain why the iron filings have this shape if you don't recognize the magnetic field? And the answer is absolutely not. What's the nature of it? The body and its cells are like iron filings. Medicine is trying to understand the nature of the body by looking at the iron filings. And quantum physics says, if you don't understand that invisible field, you can't ever understand what's happening in the body. And then you say, well, what does this field constitute? Well, it's what is called the matrix, which is an interesting word, because Max Planck, one of the founders of quantum physics, talked about this invisible shaping field and gave it the name the matrix. And that, of course, has been used in the movie. And in fact, people have talked about this matrix. Some people refer to it as the divine matrix. My friend Greg Braden, who wrote a book about that, meaning not only is this the invisible field, the energy field, but it equivalent to many people what is God and spirit. Okay, so invisible forces, whether you use the physics context and talk about invisible forces as fields, or you use the spiritual context that says the invisible forces are spirit, the spirit and the field at least represent the same thing in modern science. So science is bringing the spiritual concept of invisible forces into play into the physical world that was left out by Newtonian physics. Now the problem, conventional allopathic medicine is completely locked into Newtonian physics. Doesn't even bring the mind into the concept of healing, which is interesting because they actually, in a medical education, medical students get about 15 minutes in their entire academic career of a thing called the placebo effect. And the placebo effect is simply the mind can change the character of health. In other words, if you believe that this drug is the miracle drug you've been looking for and you take it, your mind believing it's the miracle drug can heal you, while the drug itself was nothing more than a sugar pill. And now that's an established fact. One-third of all medical healings are due to the placebo effect. Okay? It becomes very important. Now comes, well, we left something out of the picture in the education. Not that it's out of the picture in the research, but in the education it says, the placebo effect is when you have positive thoughts and it generates a healing response. What they don't talk about in the books and in the general mass media is something called the nocebo effect. The nocebo effect is the same as the placebo effect, except the thoughts are of a negative nature. And what's the point? It's thoughts that are powerful, whether they're positive or negative. And while we give attention to the positive thoughts, called placebo effect, creating healing, what we know and what we don't talk about is that a negative thought, which constitutes what is called a nocebo effect, is as powerful as a placebo, but in the opposite direction. So a negative thought can not only make you sick, a negative thought can kill you in much the exact same power and using the same mechanism that a positive placebo thought can heal you. And this becomes important because psychologists tell us that 70% or more of our thoughts as conventional people are negative and redundant. Meaning, every day 70% of people's thoughts are actually taking health away from their lives and actually bringing less quality to their lives, and they don't count it because it's just that little thought that runs in their head. And yet, scientifically, it's the equivalent of the placebo effect, but backwards. So this has to come into medicine, but there's an unfortunate part about medicine, and that is medicine is not really the free avenue of research and investigation as we think it is. It is controlled by money, and unfortunately this is where the pharmaceutical industry has undue influence and keeps us from looking at healing that does not involve chemicals and drugs, only for the simple reasons this. pharmaceutical company makes money by selling chemicals. If we talk about how you can heal yourself with your mind, then that product doesn't sell very well. And there's a parallel here, because let's look at the very obvious. We live in a world where there are many other forms of providing energy besides fossil fuel, many of them very efficient, much more effective. Where are they? And the answer is, it's not in the interest of the oil companies to support free energy, sources of power. And it's the same thing with medicine. It's not in the interest of the pharmaceutical industry to support free energy healing. And therefore, it's a subject that gets no coverage except for that 15 minutes on the placebo and then dropped out of the system. And yet it is the most important new understanding, and it's not new because it's 100 years old or more. It's new only because we're beginning to look at it in spite of the fact that drug companies don't want us to see it.
So you talk about positive thinking now. Do you think that positive thinking, simply consciously thinking positive things, that that's enough to really have a difference?
The problem with the concept of power, the power of positive thinking, is people just think, oh, well, if I just have positive thoughts, then my life should be affected. And this is why positive thinking has a real bad rap in the public. And the reason is this. Having a positive thought does not in any way necessitate that those positive thoughts actually manifest themselves. And there's a piece that was left out. And if you don't understand the piece, then you're shouting into the wind with your positive thoughts. Nothing's going to happen. And the fact is this. When you're having positive thoughts, you're using your mind. The new biology reveals that the invisible forces that collectively we refer to as mind, that these form a field which shape biology. Well, here's what's important. Yes, the mind influences biology, but there are two parts to the mind that are completely different than one another, yet they work together. We confuse them, we tie them together, and yet they represent two entities working in two different fashions. There's the conscious mind and what is called the subconscious mind. Now, here's what the very important people have to know this, okay, and here's what it is. The conscious mind is our creative mind that is connected to our personal identity and our spiritual selves. That makes us all unique. Each of us has our own personal conscious mind. But what becomes very significant is this, is the subconscious mind is equivalent to a tape player. It's exactly what it is. It records experiences and then plays them back. And so now let's take a look and say, well, wait, there's a thinking mind, and then there's the tape player mind. And what's different about them is very profound. So let's talk about two fundamental differences first. The tape player, the subconscious mind, as an information processor, as the equivalent of a computer, is a million times more powerful an information processor than is the conscious mind. So when you look at the power between the conscious and subconscious is a million times more powerful. Number two, on a day-by-day basis, the subconscious mind runs our biology about 95 to 99% of the time. So while you're having all these wonderful thoughts, that's not the conscious mind's not running the show. It's a subconscious mind. Then comes the issue is, well, the subconscious mind got programs in it. Yes. And the subconscious mind is not evil or good. The subconscious mind is a tape player. As much as you can say, here's a tape player. It's good or bad. No, the tape player's not good or bad. The programs can be good, and the programs can be bad. So blaming the subconscious mind as a negative thing, that's the first mistake. It's a tape player. The programs that we got, that's the source of the problems that most of us face. And these programs could limit our abilities and take away our powers, which essentially they do. Now, the relevance about positive thinking is this. Positive thinking is a creative thought that comes from the conscious mind. Okay, so I sit here and I'm going to have all these wonderful thoughts. I'm going to close my eyes and visualize all these wonderful things. Now stop and go back to the mechanical character of it. A, I'm having these thoughts with a little tiny processor called the conscious mind, and I'm competing with the programs that are in the subconscious mind. So if I have a thought for being healthy or being in a good relationship, and I'm doing positive thinking. And at the same time, I've acquired programs in my development that said, you're not as healthy as you think you are, and you're not that good a person to have those kind of relationships. Then look, I'm now pitting my positive thoughts against my programs, and they're opposite. But this one works on a little tiny processor, and this processor is a million times more powerful. So right away, it's like, who's going to win in that challenge? The answer, of course, the subconscious is going to win, okay? But here comes the other part. While I can try to maintain positive thoughts in my life using my conscious mind, this conscious mind only operates less than 5% of the day. That says 95% or more of the day, I'm operating from the other belief system. The point is, do the math. How powerful are positive thoughts? And the answer is, unless the subconscious has the same programs and agreement as the conscious mind, power of positive thinking will not work. It will not work because you're competing against a much more powerful processor. Okay? And this is the problem. And now here comes, let's add one more piece to the problem, then it really manifests the big problem that people in this world are facing today. And that is, the conscious mind and subconscious mind work together in tandem. Meaning, my conscious mind, as small a processor as it is, can run any aspect of my biology. I can run anything. I could run my heartbeat right now for you. I can speed up and slow down my heartbeat. I can change my body temperature with my conscious mind. We used to think those were involuntary, that the body had a part of the brain that ran all the things and your conscious mind only ran things like your muscles. That's not true. We now know that people who are very conscious can control every function in their body. But here's the problem. The conscious mind is a very small processor. The subconscious mind is a million times more powerful. You have to take care of your breathing, your heartbeat, your digestion, all your functions, your immune system, your respiration, your digestion, excretion. Your conscious mind can't focus on all that. So the nature of it is the function of the subconscious to carry out all the details and can carry out every one of the details. We could be essentially unconscious, which most people are. And our lives look exactly the same. Why? Because once you learn how to get dressed, you know how to get dressed. Once you know how to drive a car, you don't have to be conscious how to drive a car. You already got the program. So everything that we learn in our subconscious mind becomes automatic behavior, meaning it frees up the consciousness. So the consciousness doesn't have to be dealing with all the tasks. Well, when you free up the consciousness, then you have time for creative thinking. But here's the issue, and this is the catch. When the consciousness is not focusing on some job or some task, and let's say it's on a daydream mode, it's thinking about your vacation next week. You're going on vacation and you're thinking about the plans of your vacation in your conscious mind. Well, if your conscious mind is thinking about the vacation, who's running the day-to-day, moment-to-moment life? The answer is the subconscious. But now here's the catch. Does the conscious mind observe the behavior as it automatically plays from the subconscious mind? And I go back and say, well, where was your mind? It was thinking about the future. Well, if it's thinking about the future, then it wasn't paying attention, right? And the answer is, aha. The nature of the trade-off is the subconscious mind can run everything when the conscious mind is busy. If the conscious mind is busy, it's not paying attention. And so when it's not paying attention, it does not see the programs that are playing the subconscious mind. So to give you an amusing anecdote about it, is you know somebody and you know their parent, and you realize that this person and their parent pretty much have the same behavior. And so you, in enthusiasm, you burst on the scene, you say, you know, Mary, you're just like your mom. As soon as you say that to Mary, back away from Mary. Why? Because she's not going to take this in welcoming news for her. She's going to say, how can you say that? To her, she's not like her mom at all. And the issue is interesting. It's like the joke is, everybody else can see that Mary's like her mom, but Mary can't. Why not? And the answer is, because when she's playing the programs which she got from her mother, which are in her subconscious, she's playing them because she's not paying attention. And so when they play, she doesn't see them. So she's surprised when people say that she behaves like her mom, even though that's what her life is all about. Now, the conclusion of why all this dialogue and why was it all important, the answer is this. That we do not see the subconscious when it plays. The subconscious has programs in it that we primarily get from other people in our development. And the significance about that is that if we are operating from this subconscious mind and not seeing it, then we're also not seeing that we're playing programs that may not be in any way supporting who we are and what we want. The programs, those are in the conscious mind. So the idea is, when life doesn't work, when you don't find that relationship that your positive thinking was looking for, when you don't get that health that you were looking for because your positive thinking was asking for it, we have a tendency, therefore, to blame the outside world because, as far as I know, my intention was for all these wonderful things. And when I don't get it, it can't be me because I have all these wonderful positive intentions. What we didn't see was, while we were having those positive intentions, using our conscious mind for those positive intentions, the subconscious was running the show. And we didn't see that we generally sabotage and destroy or limit our own lives with behaviors that are not supporting us. And why this is important is because then we all generally cop the attitude that there are forces outside of me that control my life, and I am a victim of this world, and I can't do anything about it as a victim. And as soon as you buy that, you are a victim. And the only problem was, it was your own subconscious programming that led to the life that you have. And that if you can understand that, and then try to work with it, then you can change your subconscious programming and change your life. Now comes a problem. And the problem is, we also bought this, and it's not true, that there's somebody in the subconscious. Meaning, if my conscious finds my subconscious engaging in some behavior that's not supporting it, then my conscious is talking to myself, and my conscious is saying, Bruce, God, that was stupid. You could do better than that. And you're having this inner dialogue, and you're talking to yourself and being very upset about the fact that your behavior seems to be out of control. Who are you talking to? And I love this because the reality is we're thinking we're talking to ourselves, and that's going to fix something. And what is it going to fix? Well, the program's in that subconscious. And here's where the problem lies. Subconscious is a tape player. There's nobody in there. The same exact truth holds in this case. Get a tape player, put a cassette tape in it, push play, the program's running, and you don't like the programming, so here's what I want you to do. Go up and talk to the tape player. Go up and talk to it. Suggest that it change the program. Even tell it what you want it to play. Do all this, and then you realize the program still plays, it doesn't change, and then you get more upset with yourself. Why? Because you've asked this program to change, it's not changing yet, then you get mad at yourself, you start yelling at yourself, and now you're berating yourself because you can't control the tape. Then that doesn't work, and then of course the last step, you have to bring God in, because obviously you tried to change your life, and it didn't work, so only God has to come in here now and change the tape. And the joke is, how much talking to a tape player does it take before the tape changes? And the answer is, you can talk to your blue in the face and it will not change. It's not that you can't change the tape, but you have to learn how to push the record button. And then you can record new programs in the subconscious. But our old belief system, like conventional psychology, let's go over and find out why my life is this way. Oh yeah, my mom did this to me, and my dad did this, and my friends did this, and now I make a whole list of all the reasons why my life is this way. I'm very clear. My conscious mind's got, oh God, I could play that movie. I can see it. And the question is, now that you're aware, did it change the tape player? And the answer is no. And that's why people get so upset. They go through all of this psychology, counseling, and stuff. They know all the reasons. They still have the same life. So the issue is, you want to make change? Then you have to learn how to engage the tape player in a record mode and not just talk to it.
What would be great is to kind of hear a little bit how that whole feeling of letting yourself listen to what's going on. It seems like when you do EFT, that's a big part of it, listening to what's going on. If you can kind of talk about that and refer to how that works with EFT.
In our subconscious mind, what we have are these programs that we acquired, and many of them are not very supportive, okay? And as I mentioned, that psychologists reveal that 70% of our thoughts are negative and redundant. So as you're sitting at the traffic light and you're waiting for the light and these thoughts are running through your head, you can start to listen to them for a moment. Stop and be analytical and listen to these thoughts, and you start to realize you're saying things, well, that won't happen, or I'm not that lucky, I can't get that, oh, she won't pay any attention to me. These are thoughts. And then realize, since these thoughts are programming the biology, and these are the thoughts that are just running like a faucet from your subconscious mind, you're actually hearing what kind of beliefs you're dealing with. And the first level of really owning the power over your life is to listen to these thoughts. Because if you listen to them, you're going to have to stop and say, my God, if I listen to all these thoughts, of course my life is not pretty. And once you own that these thoughts are important and you can hear these thoughts, then you have access to say, well, wait a minute, I decide not to, I don't want to hear that thought. I want a different thought. And that's when your conscious mind steps in and says, give me the wheel. Because the subconscious has been driving the vehicle all this time. And most of us think our conscious mind is like a backseat, you know, passenger watching this car go out of control from the back seat, screaming directions to the front seat, and the driver is not paying any attention. And that is because the subconscious is the driver until you own the responsibility to stand in the front or sit in the front, put your hands on the wheel, and drive the vehicle yourself. The moment you do that, you have power. If you don't do that, then the subconscious is running the show. And then you might say, but that sounds really hard and it's really difficult. It is difficult and hard, but guess what? I love this. Most people in their lives at some point did this with such amazing success that if you give them a chance to think back on it, they'll immediately go back to that period. It was called falling in love. And what does falling in love have to do with it? And the answer is this. Think about this. You're running your life, for, as I said, 95% or more from the subconscious. I say, the day before you meet this special person that comes into your life, how long did it take you to get dressed? You say, oh, about 5 minutes. I got my clothes on. I was out of the house. I say, how long did it take you to eat? You say, oh, scarf down a burger, wipe my face on my sleeve. I was out of there in 10 minutes or less. And then I say, oh, that's really cool. And I say, but now today you met this person and you all of a sudden your heart just opened up and you're just like, oh, this is the whole life for me. This person is this whole life. And now you're going to go on a date. How long does it take you to get dressed? Sure as heck, more than 5 or 10 minutes to get dressed. It may take you an hour or two to get dressed. You go out to dinner. And I say, ha, I bet you, guess what? You remember every rule of etiquette, and you use it. You use the right fork. You blot your face with your napkin. You talk without having food in your mouth. And all of a sudden, it's like, wow, you're running perfect. What is the difference between that day when you're going on this date and the day before when that person wasn't in your life? And the answer is, once this person comes into your life, you want to be so sure that you represent who you are in your consciousness to this person that you're not relying on the tapes. You're watching yourself get dressed. You didn't just get dressed. You're making sure everything is right. The words that you say at the dinner conversation didn't just get blurted out. You actually thought about the words before you said them. You're creating this with consciousness rather than just playing a tape that you could have pushed the button and had conversation with the day before. And all of a sudden you start to realize, with this consciousness, meaning looking back at yourself and not letting the mechanism run by automatic subconscious tapes, go back and think about that period of love. Why is it so exciting to people? You were your healthiest. You were your happiest. You were on top of the world. Everything was perfect in your life. 10 minutes before you met this person, you could have given me a list why everything was wrong. But once you met this person, you are now on top of the world. And then you have to realize, well, what was the difference? The answer was, rather than relying on programs, when you fell in love in that honeymoon period, you didn't rely on the program. You relied on observation of yourself, being self-conscious. And when you were self-conscious, all of a sudden, guess what? You didn't make the stupid programs play that were programmed into you from before. You were in charge. And this was a beautiful part. It's called the honeymoon. But then all of a sudden you have to say, how come when I think about the honeymoon, I have to go back? How come the honeymoon isn't here? You had that, you met your partner 10 years ago. It was that exciting honeymoon period. And today you have life. What happened to the honeymoon? And the answer is, at some point, after the honeymoon is going on for a while, your outside life does come back in. Your job, your commitment, your debts, your whatever you're working on, all these things come back in. The moment they come back in, you have to think about them. Yeah, but what mind do you use when you think about them? The conscious mind. Well, if the conscious mind is now engaged in thinking about your problems, then who's running the show? The subconscious mind. And it's fun because the first time this really happens in the relationship, you're thinking about these issues in your life, your partner, your love comes up to you, asks you a question, but this time your conscious is really still like dealing with the issues and you respond using the tape. Here's the big surprise. To your partner, this behavior was never seen before because it was that tape that you never played. Now they look and they go, what kind of behavior is that? They don't even know who you are. And they may even say, well, that's not, I've never seen that kind of behavior. And here's the, they go back and say, but you as a person who just played the tape, remember, you don't see the tape when it plays. So now you've been accused of not being yourself. And then you become very defensive and you go, what are you talking about? I've always been this way, which is actually a fact. But you didn't understand what the comment was about because you didn't see the subconscious response. And then that's when the honeymoon starts to weaken. And as soon as your life gets back in and you stop being self-conscious is when you lost the immediate control over that healthy, happy, harmonious, loving period that you call the honeymoon.
You were talking before when we first started, you were kind of explaining the energetic field and how it's something obvious because of the magnets. Then you talked about positive thinking. And can you kind of go into tapping itself, into energy psychology itself? So what? We know that there's this energy field, but do we actually have the ability to tap into it?
The energy fields out there, our thoughts are the energy fields, so can we tap into it? In fact, if you're tapped in your thoughts, then you're already tapped in the energy field because the thought isn't material or mechanical in the first place. It is the energy field. And that these thoughts are very powerful. Rupert Sheldrake, the biologist who talks about morphogenic fields and morphic fields, talk about these invisible fields giving shape to matter, which is exactly what Einstein talked about. So you have to recognize your thoughts are part of this field. What's interesting about EFT is that it is a process which really, in some sense, engages like super learning. And super learning is the equivalent of pushing the record button on the subconscious mind. Meaning, we got our programming, our fundamental programming, from fetal development, we got our programming from the last half of fetal development through the first 6 years of our lives. And there's a reason why this is a special programming part of our lives. And the answer is that our brain, when we look at the EEG, the electrical activity of the brain, that a child doesn't express consciousness as we know it, alpha waves, as a predominant brain state until after 6 years of age. Before 6 years of age, their predominant brain states are theta. But theta, which is the state of imagination, so when you go back and you realize that kids less than six live in mixing the real world and the imaginary world, that's an expression of their brain function. But it also is important to recognize that theta is equivalent to a hypnagogic trance. That if I want to hypnotize you, I have to get you out of consciousness and drop you into like this theta place. And when you're in theta, I bypass consciousness and the program goes into the subconscious mind. Now stop and say, but a child's brain is in this theta state essentially up to the first 6 years of its life. So the point is, our first 6 years, we're not actually engaging in consciousness. We're just downloading experiences. Well, these experiences, then we play them back as our life characters and our life behaviors. Yeah, but you downloaded them from other people. So that you download your parents' behaviors, and they become your behaviors. But then again, as I said, as you get older, you don't see this because they're subconscious, and your conscious rarely observes this. So we start to play these behaviors that really represent other people's behaviors. And so when we're not being conscious of ourselves, the behaviors that we play are not necessarily supporting us in any way. They're most likely sabotaging us. Why? Because we acquired them from other people. And this is an unfortunate principle of child development. There's a name for it in New Zealand and Australia. But it applies here as well. It's called cutting the tall poppy. What it means is this. If you grow poppies, they generally grow up all to the same height. But every now and then, some poppy shoots up higher than all the other poppies. And so what the gardener will do is cut the head off of the tall poppies. And when they talk about this in child development, they say this, that children are like these poppies. If some poppy, some child, expresses abilities greater or different than all the other children, the tendency is to cut their head off and put them back down to be average again. So what do we acquire in our development is that we're just average people, that we have no extraordinary powers, that even healing isn't one of our powers, because when we were in that 0 to 6 year period, every time we got sick, we were told we had to go to the doctor to get healed. That's an experiential program. So what does my subconscious mind learn from this experience? Every time I'm sick, I have to go to the doctor. Why? Apparently, it's a step before you get healed. So we build that into the program, and then, which is interesting, is that we have an innate ability to heal ourselves. That's what the placebo effect is all about. But when we put in a program that says, I have to go to the doctor before I get healed, then what you do is actually stall your own ability to heal yourself until you go to the doctor. And the joke, many people get well on the way to the doctor without having any treatment. And the reason is, they already have the ability to get well, but the program step said, until you do this next step, then the healing doesn't start. So we deprogram our ability to heal ourselves. People hear from parents the things that are just common from family to family. Who do you think you are? You're not smart enough. You're not good enough. Whatever it is, you're not good at this or you're not good at that. These pronouncements to a child, 6 or under, are hypnagogic trances. So the important aspect is you want to see why your life might not be working the way it is. It's not because of what you're thinking today. It's because of the original programs you got from 0 to 6. And it's a fact now of science that the illnesses and diseases that we express as adults were primarily programmed into us in the pre-conception, the prenatal and neonatal phases of our lives. In other words, whatever programs we got in the first 6 years of our lives apparently control our adult health and our adult behaviors.
How are they scientifically proving that?
Well, much of this is just research going back into, there's so much, you know, epidemiological data and status of where people came from and what happened to them. And there are so many other actual experiments, things like studying what is called the grandmother effect, where women who were starved at the end of World War II, let's say in the Netherlands, because there was no food, when they had children, their children were essentially born underweight and a bit malnourished. And it turned out that the offspring of these women that were born that way also expressed the same traits, even though there was no issue there. What they started to find was there's a lineage of things that's passed down. It's part of what is the new genetics called epigenetics, where environment shapes the genes. And this is the feedback of the new biology. It's not the genes controlling life. It's how the environment shapes genes that controls life.
Going back, you talk a lot about the placebo effect. Now, what would you say to someone who sees energy psychology and EFT and says, well, that's just the placebo effect? It's because you think...
Great! The placebo effect is great no matter which way you get it. I mean, look, let's go back. There was a period when some people were selling what was called Laetril, which was some extract of apricot seeds as a cure-all for some particular cancer. The large number of people that healed themselves by this process, the tremendous number of them. And then, of course, they found that this Laetril wasn't any more valid than a sugar pill. And everybody attacked the pill and the Laetril and all that. They didn't stop and say, yeah, but what about all these people who healed their lives because they believed in it? And to me, it's a joke because much of medicine is exactly the same. I mean, Prozac, one of the biggest selling drugs on this planet. The drug company research revealed directly that Prozac is no more effective than a sugar pill in dealing with these issues. In a sense of the chemistry, Prozac has no real chemistry that deals with this issue. It is one of the best placebos on the market. And the reason is, most placebos are sugar or chalk pills. You take the pill, it was the taking of the pill that actively engaged. But here's a Prozac. It's the equivalent of a chalk or a sugar pill, but it has side effects. You can feel it in your body. So it's not you're just taking a sugar pill. You're taking a pill, which is the first step, but then you feel something, and that enhances the placebo effect, makes it even more powerful because it's like, well, I know it's working. I can feel it. And that is far better than just a plain sugar pill. So what's the point? Medicine sells placebos, and nobody yells at them for doing it, although it's quite dangerous because those placebos have very negative influences on children that they're prescribed to. But the reality is it's a guaranteed, experimentally revealed placebo. What's the issue? I don't care what it is. If I can get my mind to work for me, then I don't care what you call it. You can call it the latest drug or the latest placebo. I don't care which one it is. If it works, That's what counts. And why are placebos better? And the answer is because they have no side effects. And that's, so I prefer to do the placebo any day of the week, because a placebo is a real event. And as I said, 1/3 of all medical healings are directly attributed to the placebo effect and not the medical process. So basically, medicine is fraught with it as well. And I believe personally that's what we should be researching and not the drugs.
So do you think that then the actual tapping on meridian points could be a placebo effect and not have the... the effect, but it works because you think it's a positive thing?
I think that, see, I'm going to be more weird than most of your people, because I'll go back to the full bottom line. And the bottom line is perception and belief. And I don't care what it is, all the other steps in between are like icons. You do this and now, oh, I did the step, okay? Because really it is, it's based on the individual. It's always been that way. But because we've been so programmed to devalue ourselves and disempower ourselves, that we look at ourselves as victims and frail biological entities, you know, ripe for bacteria to eat us up and all these other things. It's like, this is totally untrue. So the issue is, we have to start from that belief and change these beliefs of who we are. We are profoundly powerful people. Look, you can walk across hot coals, you know, a woman can lift a car off of an infant without thinking about it. Down south, Baptist fundamentalists of the Pentecostal faith work themselves up in a Jesus state and drink strychnine in toxic doses to demonstrate that God protects them. They're not harmed by the strychnine. I mean, you can walk across fire, you can drink poison, you can lift thousands of pounds. Where's the frail image come from? And that's a belief. But the problem is, if you believe you are frail, if you believe you are susceptible, if you believe you have a terminal illness, they manifest, because that's called the nocebo effect.
So then, with what has been your experience then, if any, with energy psychology? Have you used it in your life and finding that it was a...
And then, in reality, I of course have used energy psychology, and most profoundly and effectively, and because my whole life has changed. Once I recognized I had programs that were limiting me, then I realized that if I didn't change those programs, then I would be the victim of programs. So I found that energy psychology was one of the most effective ways to rewrite the program, because although there are a variety of different modalities, I think collectively all of them facilitate a super learning process, which is enables a rapid rewriting of subconscious beliefs. It's actually the same state our brain was in when we were younger than six, at that point when we were downloading programs. I think energy psychology puts that brain into that modality. And with that modality means, then as easily as, you know, talking this new program into yourself, you are actually re-recording over your past experiences and putting new beliefs in. And as soon as you do that, then you operate from the new beliefs and not the old ones. And I love it, because as it comes from the subconscious, so you don't even have to think about it. You just program what you want in, let go of it, go about your life, and all of a sudden things show up. It's like, well, how'd they get there? And the answer was, well, the subconscious was working when you weren't paying attention, but this time working for you, made all the connections to bring things into your life to manifest what the program was. And that's the function of the subconscious, and that's why it's so profoundly important. Its job is to take a program and then make coherence between the program that's in the subconscious and the life you're experiencing, which is good if you have good programs, and is terribly toxic if you have programs that are not supporting you.
Do you believe that the unconscious mind is actually just in the mind, and that everything that's going on with us is based...
The unconscious mind is connected to every part of our physical body. It's our skin and our interior organs and everything. So the unconscious mind is reading every physical part of our body, as well as what's going on outside of our body. So the subconscious mind is this magnificently powerful processor, reading both internal and external environments to the fullest degree. So it's a reflection of its programs and its readings. That's what it tries to do. It has programs, it reads the environment, and tries to make coherence between the two.
So then do you feel like then tapping is directly connected to the unconscious mind, and that's why it might be so effective?
Yeah, because the skin is part of the brain anyway. So that's where the brain came from, the skin. So that you're really, like Braille, you're talking to the body with Braille instead of words, and more or less. So there's a feedback to this, but it's really also tied in with the intention of the practitioner and the intention of the recipient and the harmony that they generate together, because it's a working relationship. EFT isn't done on you, it's done with you. So you have to be a participant, and I think the issue is a lot of people are so skeptical of things that they want things to be done to them. And it's like, well, that's the big problem. You're a participant in your life. You're not a recipient of things. You have to participate. So it really is the people that are ready to get healed are going to be much more affected by this. And people that are like, oh, I'll just do it because somebody said to, that's a different thing. They're doing it not because they want it. They're doing it for whatever other reasons. And so it's important that to recognize that not only is a practitioner important in the process, but the recipient of this healing has to be participate in the process as well.
So then going off of talking about healing, if someone's using some kind of source of energy psychology to heal a physical ailment, and for example, we have one lady who said after tapping for 5 minutes, she had MS and she could start walking again, and she could walk without any drugs for 4 months. Now, in that case, how do you explain to someone someone might be a little bit confused when they think, well, the body can't heal itself that fast. Like, how can you physically get rid of a rash in the matter of seconds?
Because our belief system of what the body was based on the Newtonian view of chemicals and chemistry, which then has time elements involved, because chemical reactions take time, and then you start to say, all of this must take a lot of time, and that, so we buy that, that's a given belief. Except the reality is my research revealed that every cell is the equivalent of a programmable chip. Every cell, the nucleus is the hard drive with programs in it. The nucleus can form anything out of a human body. What the cell forms is based on what's typing on the keyboard, which is the surface of the cell, the environment. So why is this relevant? It's how fast does it take you to change a program in your computer? And the answer is, well, virtually instantaneously. And that's why it's called spontaneous remission. Once you change the field, it changes the programming of the system completely, and the field shapes matter. A changed field provides for changed matter.
You could go into university and write some few fundamental concepts that you wish you would teach. Can you tell us just kind of really basic, some fundamental things that you think you believe is important for?
Absolutely. Yeah. I've listed what I've called the three assumptions of the apocalypse. These are assumptions that you can go to school right now and get taught these as beliefs, like this is written in stone. And they're completely wrong, and they take us off track. The three assumptions are simply, number one, the belief that is taught is that biology and the world we live in operates according to Newtonian principles. Unfortunate part about that is quantum mechanics 100 years ago said that's obviously not true, and physicists know this is not true, and yet medicine doesn't buy into it because it still focuses on the material reality and lets go of the invisible shaping fields that quantum physics emphasizes as primary. Okay, so we have to change that belief system. We have to get people to recognize that the field and the thoughts and all these other things are as important as anything else in shaping the matter we live in. Number two, the belief which I blew away years ago, but it's still being taught in school, is the concept that genes control life. This is totally false. Genes control nothing. Control is an action. A gene is a blueprint. It's a physically, literally, a string with blueprint data on it. Why is that relevant? Well, it's interesting. Go to an architect's office, and the architect's working on a blueprint, and then lean over the architect's shoulder and say, is that blueprint on or off? And he looks at you, the blueprint's not on or off, it's a blueprint. Yeah, but we talk about genes being on and off, like genes are turning on and genes are turning off. And the question is, but genes are blueprints. They can't turn on and off. There is no on and off. It's just the blueprint. It's a pattern. What we have failed to focus on, because we gave genes a character of self-actualization, that my genes decided to do something. It's like, okay, now we're a victim of the genes. But it turns out Biologists know that this is not true. Biologists know that genes are not turned on and off. Genes are read or not read, like blueprints. Then all of a sudden it says, well, it's not the blueprint that's important. If the blueprints were self-actualizing, an architect could go by a building site, drop the blueprints off, come back 2 weeks later, and the building will be there. That's what we think about animals and plants. The genes are blueprints, and they'll control all this. It's like, no, the blueprints are important. I'm not saying they're not. You got the bad blueprints, you got some problems going on here. But the issue is, it's not the presence or absence of a blueprint. It's whether the blueprint is being read. And then you say, well, then who reads the blueprint? And the answer is, a contractor. And who's the contractor? The mind is the contractor. The mind reads genes. The mind can change the genes readout. Here's something so blow away that most people can't in their conventional world make sense of it, because it's like, it goes like this. The mind, through what is called epigenetic mechanisms, can start with a single gene blueprint and create over 30,000 different versions of products from the same blueprint. 30,000 different products from the same blueprint. All of a sudden you realize, my God, you can infinitely vary the expression of the gene. And the answer is, yes. And why has this become relevant to all of us? And the answer is, because many of us think genes control our lives. And yet we don't realize that we modify the readout of the genes. So we could be totally healthy and our mind can cause cancer. Our mind can cause any disease, diabetes, anything like that. And what's interesting is the flip side is some people come here with actually defective genes. And guess what? With their mind, they can rewrite those genes and make them normal. So the genes are not the limiting factor, it's the mind. The third assumption that is actually playing great havoc in the world today and is leading to a destruction of the civilization, so it's very profound, is our belief in Darwinian evolution. Now, before everybody goes nuts, I believe in evolution. And Darwinian evolution is a version of how evolution can occur. It's a version that says that life is a struggle and that we compete in this struggle, and the fittest are the survivors. So we wake up and look at a world as not a peaceful, harmonious place. We look at a world as a jungle with a war going on, and that it's a dog-eat-dog world, that you go out there and you have to go fight for your survival. So we believe that. We operate our lives based on competition, trying to beat the other one out. When it turns out, the new understanding of evolution says, my God, is evolution occurred, but it occurred via cooperation among all the living species. The biosphere that's out here is not just a random bunch of pieces thrown out in the field. It's a cooperative, interactive community. And so all of a sudden you want to understand the nature of evolution. Evolution was based on cooperation, not competition. So that our whole human philosophy of competing for the struggle has done a couple of things. One, it creates a struggle. Why? Because if you believe it, that's the nocebo effect, then you will manifest struggle to say, yeah, life is a struggle. I believe it and see it is, okay? And the fact is, then we become competitors in this. And then we actually are beating back the cooperation and destroying the environment. And this is the problem we face right now. The crisis that we face in the world is that we look at the world as a bunch of collection of individual pieces and didn't own the reality that the whole biosphere is one living integrated community as a whole, and based on cooperation, and we're the elements on the outside that are like viruses destroying the community. And guess what? Nature is the living thing. Nature looks at humans now as a parasite, as a pest. And nature is in the process of destroying humanity in this process. Why? Because we're just disrupting the harmony that was called the garden. So the new thinking has to bring us into the reality is that our beliefs of competition and warfare and struggle and survival completely miss the point. It's really based on loving harmony, thriving, community, cooperation. These are the words of life. All the other words are bringing us to the destruction that we face now. The problem about the new biology is that most of the forces are invisible, therefore we don't see them, and therefore we cop the attitude that things happen to us and we're not involved. In fact, when I used to close my lectures years ago, 10, 15 years ago, I'd come to the obvious conclusion the science revealed, and that was simply this. When you understand the nature of this new biology, you recognize that you are personally responsible for everything in your life. Well, I want to tell you, no matter how much they love the lecture, up to that moment, as soon as I said that, you thought that I had, you know, just irritated a mob out there. They got all upset with me because of this answer. I mean, they would grumble and be very upset because that was the conclusion. And there was no other way to say it because that was a conclusion. I remember one day one woman was so upset. She was crying. She came and talked to me after the lecture was over and her husband was with her. And she was so upset because she could not own the things in her life that she was responsible for. So I tried to say, she wanted me to come up with a different conclusion. And I was thinking, but that's the conclusion. And I got nervous and all of a sudden it hit me. And I said, how about this? And I said, you are personally responsible for everything in your life once you become aware that you are personally responsible for everything in your life. She actually smiled and I realized, okay, this works. And the point is, if you don't know about these processes, these mechanisms, we're ignorant of these facts, and then things happen to us, of course we don't know what's going on and what can I do about it? Nobody told me. But once you know, then you can't go back and do that anymore. You can say, okay, history, everything that happened to me up to this point, I was oblivious to, I was ignorant of, I don't know. But from this point forwards, I'm going to take control. Now I own my life. So the reality is we must get people to own who they really are and how it really works. And this is the requirement of the new science. And it's just slowly entering in the field because, unfortunately, there are too many institutions that have made a very good living off of us being victims. And they have no real interest in seeing us gain our power, which includes the government, medicine, the church. Every one of these has essentially survived very, very well by disempowering us. But that's the future. It's not going to be that. Okay, you got any short questions? Yeah, let's do the short ones, the one-liners.
Well, just one, because you are Frusik B. So, are you good with filming?
Yeah.
You are the science guy.
Hey, know? Mr. Science Guy,
you're
right.
Science Guy. So, is there a way to prove that energy psychology works? Scientifically?
Sure. The way to prove it very scientifically is just the way any science experiment is done. You get the interpretation of what's going on, then you do the experiment, then you read the results. And if the results are consistent and line up with the experiment, then whatever was going on in the experiment influenced the outcome. That's the way all science is done. And this is why it's so fun to me, because I've been involved with energy psychology. I see people change their lives all the time. And then my conventional scientists go, oh, you know, that's like, that's, you know, frou-frou stuff. And it's like, no, it's real. These people have changed their lives. And then because there's no connection of how that can happen in their allopathic thinking, they're not left with an ability to think of anything other than, well, that's, you know, that just can't be. Because they've made a very narrow limit on their belief system. That's why if we teach the alternative to the three assumptions, then the minds of these scientists and researchers will be expanded wide enough to include these mechanisms, which essentially are quantum physics. And they're not versed in quantum physics. That I already know, because I was there. And until you know that, then you're not operating on scientific principles. So I'll just tell you right now, conventional allopathic medicine is not really scientific in that it does not recognize fully the influence of the invisible energy fields in shaping matter. They do not fully own quantum mechanics as relevant to biology. And this is creating a big disconnect between real life and the science that they study.
Where do you see in 10 years from now your message and what you're teaching? How do you see it expanding?
Well, what I'm teaching, I'm just one voice now. And I mean, although I started, you know, like teaching this stuff in the 1980s, and there were not many people out there, the voice is being picked up by other people. People all over are talking about this. So I feel very, very secure that this new biology will be in place in about 10 years. And when this is the everyday thinking of people, rather than, oh, that's the weird stuff, when it becomes everyday thinking, then everyday life will manifest the characters and abilities that are provided by this new energy psychology. So I see the world profoundly changing, and it's going to do great changes in the way we treat each other, the way we interact with nature itself. It's going to profoundly alter medicine. It's going to be very different, that the mind will be very much brought into all healing to facilitate it, because we have innate abilities to heal ourselves. We're not tapping into it. It'll change all aspects of life, because when we become more conscious and we know who we are, then we'll see how valuable and important we are, as well as the environment that provided for us. And in that case, make all efforts to keep the environment as it was, because that was the environment that made us. As we destroy the environment, we destroy the field that was responsible for our presence. So as we destroy the environment, of course the issue of extinction comes up, because the environment we're creating is not the environment that provided for us. The population isn't ready for the direct healing. They need things to see it. Like, I need a pill, or I need a fancy machine with a lot of LEDs on it. Now I got some belief going here. If I just sat in front of you and say, okay, let's heal now, and you looked at me like, what the hell is this all about, you know? But, we go through ritual and we do tapping and all that. It's like, we went through a process. The process is very important, because they can't rely on themselves, so they rely on outside kinds of things, okay? That's my perception of it. It's my perception of it because I've also seen over years people say, well, when I tap here, this is going to happen, or when I tap here, this other thing happens, and I realize sometimes they switch the tapping, and it turns out the way they said it was going to be, that's the way it worked out. And I think this is an unfortunate issue, because we have no real... We don't see the value in how powerful we are personally, and therefore we put power outside of ourselves. And as long as we do that, we have to jump through hoops and things to manifest the things we want. When we would really own who we are, we could do it all right now. But the problem is that education isn't available, and that's what we need to have.
Can you give a layman's definition of quantum physics?
Up through the 1900s, our belief in physics was based on Newtonian mechanics, which said, if you want to understand the universe and the operation, what's going on, only focus on the physical material reality. Don't try to find anything in the invisible spaces. Leave that for religion. And that's actually what separated religion and science. Science said, we'll focus on the material reality, and we'll leave the invisible reality to religion. Okay? So they call that metaphysics. And the other stuff was called Newtonian physics. That's the physical thing. But in 1905, Albert Einstein published a series of papers. In those papers, he revealed something that had been recognized by earlier people like Max Planck and other people at this time, other physicists, that there were things about energy and invisible things that were going on that in some way influenced the physical matter. It was Albert Einstein who actually came down and evolved the equations to reveal what we now know, and that is this, is that atoms are not like little marbles, which is a Newtonian belief. Atoms are physical things, like, you know, the term atom means uncuttable. To the Newtonian physicists up to this point, the atom was the smallest piece of structure in the universe, that there were different versions of atoms, and as you assemble them in different assemblies, you get all different kinds of things based on the pieces of matter. But physicists started to recognize that maybe the atom wasn't as solid as we thought it was. And by 1905, when Einstein evolved his equation, it revealed that inside the atom, there are things that make up the atom, but the things that make up the atom are not physical. They're like little energy tornadoes, like little miniature little tornadoes, and they're forces. And that these forces have the character of matter. So let's say there's a tornado out behind me, a big spinning tornado, and I say, drive your car 100 miles an hour at the base of that tornado and see if you drive through the tornado. And you realize, no, the moment you hit the base of the tornado, it'll be like hitting a stone wall. And you say, yeah, but what was in the tornado? And the answer, there's nothing in a tornado. Well, you see a lot of dirt and dust that got picked up in the storm, but filter out the dirt and dust, and guess what? The tornado's still there. What is it? It's an invisible energy vortex. Is it got a force? Yeah, it's got a force. You can't drive your car through it. It'd be like hitting a stone wall. Take that tornado, shrink it down to infinitesimally small, and inside an atom are these little miniature tornadoes. An atom feels like matter. But inside of it, it's not anything but energy. And why does it feel like matter? Because those forces, you can't put your hand through the atom like you can't drive through the tornado for the same reason. So what appears to be matter when we look at ourselves are actually little energy vortices. Well, the significance is this. And if you want to understand how energy interacts, it interacts with other energy. But that's the invisible stuff. Yeah, but Newtonian physics said don't pay attention to that. And quantum physics says, no, you have to pay attention to it. So quantum physics reunites the invisible energy fields as part and parcel of the material world. And quantum physics says you want to understand that physical world, well, you also have to include the invisible stuff as well. Conventional Newtonian physics, ignore the invisible. The new physics says you actually have to know that invisible stuff because it provides the character to the other world. So there's a change, and yet, as I said, medicine still locked into the old belief. The body is chemicals and pieces and matter and structure, and you affect it by other pieces of chemicals and matter. And quantum physics says, no, you can change this much more effectively by just changing the energy in the field. And all of a sudden you start to realize when you're doing energy psychology, you are shaping, changing the energy field. And the matter corresponds to what happens in the field. So by changing the thoughts, changing the beliefs, which are not material, you in turn lead to a change of the physical expression. And that's new physics.
How does that translate into, you know, what's happening in the stomach of an over-anxious mother? Like, what's happening to that baby during that period?
Okay. When we understand the nature of the new biology, we switch from genes controlling life to the cells perceiving the environment and reading what was going on and adjusting its biology. It makes a lot of sense. I mean, so I'll give you a simple level. I walk out the door right now. If it's hot out, I read the environment, and the sense input from the environment causes my respiratory and my circulatory system to change, so I start to perspire and cool off. I'm adapting to that warm. If I walk out and it's cold, different signal, change my biology again and start to heat up my body, change the whole thing around. So it says my body adjusts to the environment because my body reads the environmental information and then goes back and adjusts the biology mechanism to respond to that environment. This is the same for all cells, whether it's a single cell in a petri dish or whether it's the trillion or so cells that make up a fetus. All cells read the environment. Now, the fetus is adjusting its genes based on the environment. But then the question is, yeah, but what environment does a fetus read? And the answer is, it reads the mother's environment. But what does that mean, reads the mother's environment? Well, here's an interesting new understanding. In the old days, when we thought genes controlled life, what was the role of a mother? To provide nutrition. Let the genes take care of the baby and the fetus. It'll grow by itself. All you have to feed it. That's all you got to do. So OBGYNs, when a woman's pregnant, basically say, are you eating well? Are you taking vitamins and minerals? Are you exercising? Why? Because those are the parameters that provide for better nutrition. And they say, well, that's all the mother does because the genes are controlling the rest. Now we know this is totally incorrect. The genes are responding to the environment. And now here comes the interesting aspect. Yes, the nutrition crosses from the mother's blood across the placenta and nourishes the fetus. Now I ask a logic question. Is nutrition the only thing that's in blood? And the answer is, of course not. In blood are emotional chemicals. In blood are the hormones and the growth factors and all the regulatory elements. Significance is, then, as the mother responds to her world and changes the components of her blood, if she's angry, she has different components than if she's happy. You know, whatever's going on in the world changes the components of the blood. So as she responds to the world, her blood is really a reflection of her response. But that blood crosses the placenta. And so guess what? The fetus is reading the mother's emotions and characters and anxieties or whatever it is. It's not getting the physical picture and the real words of what's going on. It has the sensation of the feelings and the harmony or the disharmony and the chemistry and the fear or whatever it is. It's in the chemistry. So the child, as it's developing, is reading the environment as the mother is responding to the environment. You might say, well, that doesn't make sense. And it goes, no, look. When this fetus is born, it's going to live in the environment that the mother is experiencing. So if the mother, like a Head Start program, can relay information to the fetus about how she sees the environment, then the fetus can make all the necessary kinds of adjustments before it's born, so when it's born, it fits into the environment. So the mother's characters, emotions, and attitudes shape the child. As in fact, a wonderful book, I think by the name of a woman, Sue Gerhardt, is called Why Love Matters. And she talks about this like very early period in utero to the first 2 years as where we form our emotional bones, meaning that we now realize that a child's personality and psychology is pretty much shaped by the first 2 years of its life, by the experiences that the parents are providing it, because the parents see the world in terms that the child can't. So the parent acts as the interface, explains the world and its concepts to the child, and the child lives off of those, and the child is built into this part right now. And so all of a sudden it says, this period that we've just written off is, the child's not there, it's just not really developed, and it's just goo-gooing and all that stuff. It's like, boy, did we call that one wrong. Child was downloading massive quantities of information and adjusting its genetics and biology to what was going on in the environment, creating an individual with a psychology through these experiences. So if the mother is pregnant and she's fully in love and harmony, she sends beautiful harmony and messages across the environment of safety, security, happiness, and love. But if the mother lives in fear that, how are we going to raise this child? Or what's happening in the world? How can I get nervous now? I'm in a state of fear and protection. Those signals cross the placenta and changes the genetic readout of the child, changes the physiology and the future health of that child. So what we call was this blank period where just the child was like in nowhere land. We have to recognize, this is the ultimate programming of the child for the rest of its life. Therefore, it really is incumbent upon us to have much more consideration as parents as to what our role is. We are not just feeding a child. We are shaping a child and the future generation. Parenting is an important process. It isn't, let's have a baby and drop it off at the babysitter. That's completely misunderstanding the role of what parenting is all about. Parenting shapes the child, and the child creates the future. So how we parent kids today will manifest as the future of our culture tomorrow. And all of a sudden says, and I think we have some responsibility here.
Just a question, just because I'm curious off of that, is the communication between a child and a mother after the baby is born, you talk about it's because the mom creates the environment.
Yeah.
Now, is there still, because it just spent 9 months in the womb, an actual energetic connection between the two of them that they pass information where almost subconsciously, not consciously creating the environment?
While the child is developing in utero, it's directly linked to the mother's physiology and her nervous system, and the child's functions and activities are linked to that mother. But what we now know that's very interesting is when the child is born, that it still syncs its brain activity, its EEG activity, to its mother's EEG activity, even though they're not physically connected. So if the mother is expressing some kind of behavior or character in her thought, that this can change the activity of the child's brain immediately at this point. It really reveals something that happens throughout life, but because we don't count it, and we don't recognize it. We don't pay attention to the fact that all of us are connected through our thoughts and our brain activity. I mean, it shows up mostly as like, if you haven't seen somebody in a long time, you say, I was just thinking about Bill. And all of a sudden, there's a phone call and Bill's on the phone. It's like, you guys are all connected. We're all connected. That there are experiments, even Amit Goswami, the physicist in What the Bleep, showed that when two people meditate on the presence of each being there with each other, and then they separate them, and they expose one to a strobing light that causes a brain activity called an evoked potential, real spiking, firing of the brain, that this is the guy who sees the light. This is guy is just meditating, being present with him. When this guy has the evoked potential, 50 feet away, this guy has the same evoked potential but never saw the light. And the reason is because we become linked and harmonious, and that there's more to us in this physical reality. There's an energy shaping field that gives us the shape. And this is not focused. It's a field, which means it's everywhere. So it becomes important for us to understand that just because we appear to be physically separated, it doesn't mean we are not energetically connected, which has actually been proven to be the case.
Where do you see evolution then? Like, if we keep evolving like this and becoming more conscious, yeah, do you think that it's possible to get to the point where, like, for example, language isn't something that we need to use anymore? Words aren't something we need to use anymore?
Interesting thing about language that we have trying to communicate with each other is this is really strictly almost a human experience, in a sense, that other animals do have some degree of communication. But what has happened is, by focusing on language, we have disconnected from the other communication that every other organism on this planet is involved with. All organisms are connected to each other through the energy fields. They read what's going on in the field. They respond to what's going on in the field. We do it too. But our consciousness has always been diverted away from that. Like, people, when growing up, they say, well, don't go by what you think. Listen to what the person has to say. Oh, well, as soon as you do that, then you let go of the vibrations. And why was that important? Because I can make up words and tell you anything, but my vibrations are my truth. If you could read my vibrations, then my words are not important. Do we read vibrations? Of course we do. I just love it. You get around a couple that's been together for a long time, and you'd be like a third party listening to their conversation, and you realize that half the conversation, you can't make any sense out of the sentences. Like, the subject and the object are not even there. Like, hey, do you want to go? Yes. It's like, what? And the fact that, because they're already communicating at this other level anyway. Aboriginals do this as a way of life. All organisms can do it as a way of life. We have to just go back and re-own what we had. And that would be very helpful, because if you could read the vibrations the way you're supposed to, then you would never find yourself in trouble, because as soon as you started to go wherever trouble was, you would feel bad vibes. And those bad vibes would be what the biology's warning system is to everything else that doesn't have language. When it's bad vibes, go away. When it's good vibes, come close. And that's basically the fundamental nature. If we could read bad vibes, you wouldn't be caught up in bad relationships. Simple.
So, well, with going off that, though, you also talked about in your book that you can't simultaneously be safe and grow at the same time. So do you feel that a lot of times a lot of our fears, which might seem like they're bad vibes, if we're trying to keep ourselves safe from our bad vibes, we're not letting ourselves grow? Or, like, do you feel like in order to grow, we almost have to face those things that didn't make us scared?
In the biology of the cells, it reveals that cells can have two functional states that are like digital, on and off. And these two functional states are growth and protection. They can't be in both at the same time for a simple reason as this. Growth means to take things in. Protection means to wall things off. You can't be open and closed at the same time. So it says then, well, what state are your cells in? And the answer is, what are your perceptions of the environment? Because if you live in fear and concern and threat, then you're telling your cells that we are being threatened. And in that process, they start to shut down growth processes to prepare for a protection process. But then you say, well, wait, I'm an adult. I don't need any growth. And it's like, big mistake. Reason. Every day you're losing billions and billions of your cells. Like, every 3 days, your entire gut lining is replaced. The surface cells are completely replaced. You're losing skin cells and hair cells, and they're just continuously being replaced. That's called growth. So it says, you can be 90 years old. If I stop growth, within a very short time, you will get sick and die, because if you don't maintain just the normal repair to make, you know, to compensate for the billions of cells you lose every day, it doesn't take too many days in a row before you start to get sick. So the reality is, no matter what age you are, you need to be in growth. Because the moment you compromise growth is you compromise the ability of the body to maintain itself. And so it says that when we live in a world where we are being broadcast at with all fear and you know, terrible things, and our concerns about our survival are always in question, then this media alone, by our interpretation, can cause us to get sick. And here's a fact that's like, let's face what it means. The pharmaceutical industry, since 9/11, every year has made 20% or more greater profit than the preceding year. In 5 years, they're making 100% more profit than they ever made before. Why are they doing so well? And the answer is, because we're doing so poorly. And why are we doing so poorly? Because we're living in fear. And fear is causing us to shut ourselves down, and it is that process that causes the illnesses that we face in our world today.
Can I ask you one final question?
Yeah.
when someone, say somebody has arthritis and they don't have any bone marrow left in their knees.
Yeah.
We have a guy right now. Definitely, he has cancer too, and I think we think they might all be related, and we're trying to. Yeah. Work with him on it so he can get a lust for life again, because he's stopped wanting to live because he had to quit his job because he can't walk anymore, and so trying to work on the arthritis. So when he asks us, well, you know, that pain that you get rid of, that you're getting rid of now, isn't it telling me something about the fact that my knees don't have any marrow in between them, so therefore they're probably going to be grinding and breaking each other, you know, if I continue to walk on them? It's getting rid of this, the pain in certain situations.
Yeah.
Detrimental.
And in our body, there is this wonderful dialogue between the cells and the nervous system. The nervous system sends information to coordinate the function of the cells, but the cells send information back about the conditions going on in the body. We call much of this information come back, especially when it's not working right, we refer to them as symptoms. Now, what's really important, symptoms are communications from the citizens in your body telling the brain, the government, hey, something's got to be changed here. We unfortunately have in our medical world today a belief system that healing is shutting off the symptoms. If I can shut off the symptoms, or I can shut off the pain, or I can shut off this or that, then I'm going to be better. If I take Prozac and all of a sudden I don't think about anything, then of course all my emotional problems are gone. The fact is, no, you haven't changed anything. You just shut off the symptoms. Shutting off the symptoms is like putting masking tape on the dashboard of your car so you don't have to read the gauges. Really? Okay, my engine's overheating, but I'm not paying attention. And the reality is, I don't care if you're paying attention or not, overheating is going to destroy this system. So, yeah, when you get feedback from the body, it's very important to recognize that, to take, you know, it's a message to you. So pain, for example, is a message. But there are issues where we're going to have to learn that if we destroy something because we didn't allow for its maintenance, that then sometimes this pain, which was very useful in some part, is going to be a limiting device, because if you want to walk and you have no cartilages in your knee, it's going to hurt. And yet the reality is, since you don't have that cartilage in your knee, but walking is still important, then you have a choice. It's sort of like create a callus, like on your hand. When you write and you hold your pen or your pencil at some point, that's an irritation when you hold it all the time, but at some point there's a callus and that will wall itself off. At first it started out as a blister, which hurt, and then it became a callus. Let's say walking without cartilage in your knees. At first, this is, you know, it's bringing you the attention that this isn't right, but there's a point where if you continue to do it, you will change the structure to accommodate this new behavior. And so there's points where it's important that we must change. The signal coming up was not right, but the signal going back is make it right. And in making it right, we can heal things. Now, the question is, can you replace the cartilage? The answer is yes, but will you? Probably not. And the reason? Because it's the field that shapes matter. And we live in a field of disbelief, where people do not believe that things can happen, that you can do miracles and heal your life. And so when people don't believe that, it interferes with your ability to do the miracle. So is it really interesting, because the miracles that we're talking about, the beliefs, And I wasn't raised in a Christian tradition, but this is exactly what Jesus said. He said, you can do all the miracles that I can do, even better than I can do, but you don't believe it. He said, you could renew your body with your beliefs. This was very important. But now, just to show you why a person that doesn't have a cartilage may not be able to grow the cartilage back, we'll go back to another, a paraphraser from the Bible, because I'm not a Bible scholar, but basically, Jesus could not do miracles in his own hometown. Why? He could do a miracle everywhere else. Why couldn't he do it in his hometown? Because the other people in that town didn't believe in him, because they knew him as a kid. He was just plain old Jesus. And the reality is, if the other people didn't believe in the miracle, then the miracle could not be accomplished even by Jesus. So if I'm sitting here with my cartilage gone, and everyone around me says, well, you can't replace that. That's not possible. Then even if I was Jesus at that moment, I wouldn't be able to replace that cartilage. Why? Not because I couldn't do it, but because the other people didn't believe me. And this is why we really have to break open those limitations which represent our beliefs. And most of them are disempowering beliefs.